Hello, everybody, and welcome to the history of actor training in the British Drama School. I hope you're enjoying the podcasts. The past couple have been interviews or an interview and a round table. So this week I'm going to do a solo podcast. I'm going to bring us through a paper by Clive Barker from the mid-1990s. When I started trying to understand this subject a few years ago, the subject of actor training in the British Drama School, where it came from, how it had evolved, and perhaps the direction it was heading in, this was probably the single most useful thing I read. And the provocations and the questions that are contained within it often circle through my mind when I'm talking to people. So I really want to share it with you. So I'm going to read and occasionally comment on this paper. If you're enjoying the podcast, and I really hope you are, there are lots of things you could do. You could just carry on listening. That's the most important thing. And then there are three other things you could do. You could contact me on robertprice1869@gmail.com. That's robertprice1869@gmail.com. I love getting emails from people with ideas or questions or corrections. All of those things are really useful. You could also leave me a review. That would be lovely somewhere. I think Apple Podsite podcast site is the most common place to leave reviews. And thirdly, there's a support button on the Buzzsprout site and I think on the Apple page for leaving some kind of a financial donation to help with the making and maintaining of these. That would be gratefully received, of course. But mostly listening. It's lovely to be able to talk to you. It's slightly more optimistic time, I think, in the British Drama School. I was looking at some pictures of people at schools I've taught at performing without masks. I was involved in a project at East 15 just a couple of weeks ago where when performing at a certain distance for sure, but nonetheless, the students were able to work without masks. And that was a very special thing to see. So hopefully, touch wood, fingers crossed, we're moving into a better place in terms of COVID. Theatre and drama schools are often lurching around in some kind of a crisis, and certainly that appears to be the case in the mid-1990s. So let's meet Clive Barker's paper. Clive Barker, who died in 2005, was a huge figure. I'll just read something from the obituary in The Guardian just to give you a little bit of context. Clive Barker, who's died aged 73, made an exceptional contribution to British theatre studies and its international standing. No one else of his generation travelled the extraordinary distance from a conventional stage management course to become a world leader in actor training workshops, as well as an editor and scholar of distinction. He was a pioneer in bridging the uneasy divide between professional theatre and its serious study in British universities. That's going to come up in the paper. Born in Middlesbrough, Barker might have followed his father into the steel mills, but his mother encouraged him to take a desk job in the emergent NHS. After national service, in which was then Malaya, he looked for work in the theatre. Stints of packing props for ballet companies and sweeping stages while great actors threw tantrums gave him a healthy scepticism of his profession. Clive Barker's book, Theatre Games, published in 1977, was one of those books that was always on the bookshelves when you went and looked hungrily and longingly at shelves in bookshops when you were thinking about being an actor. Hugely influential. So this is the article. It dates from the mid-1990s, 1996, I think. It's called What Training for What Theatre? The opening bit, which I'm not sure was written by Clive Barker, says this. Drama training in Britain at the present... Maybe it was written by Clive Barker. Drama training in Britain at the present time is replete with horror stories. Nothing changes. Everything changes. In the academic sector, intake numbers have been pushed far beyond the strength of the resources, whether of personnel or performing spaces designed to accommodate them. In the actor training sector, so he's separating those two things out, clearly, those students who have somehow managed to cope with their heavy fees struggle for subsistence, often by working at full-time jobs during the night and at weekends, while some have even joined the homeless on the streets. In the following article, Clive Barker attempts to disentangle the complex web of factors which have led to the situation, and to suggest how some of the artistic, if not the economic, problems might begin to be tackled. Clive Barker, who recently retired from the Joint School of Theatre Studies at the University of Warwick, is co-editor of New Theatre Quarterly, formerly an actor with Theatre Workshop, as under Joan Whittlewood, and he's also author of the seminal text Theatre Games. I thought I might just very briefly sketch out why that financial crisis. I mean, it's quite a shocking image, people studying at drama schools and sleeping and joining the homeless on the streets. I guess that's probably true. I'm not sure they're not making it up. Shocking nonetheless. There's another really important paper called the Marchant Report, which comes out a few years after that. And in the Marchant Report, Graham Marchant, I think, sketches a little bit of the context. I'm just going to read this to give us a sense about where we are in terms of funding. So now, of course, we have most drama schools are within the higher education sector, and that means that most drama school students receive a student loan in the same way everybody else does. But the situation was a lot more complicated in the 90s. This is a little explanation of it. So this is where we were in the mid-90s. Going back a little bit, Graham Marchant explains. Until the late 80s or thereabouts, students wishing to enter the profession through a regular 3-year course of study at one of these independent drama schools were independent at this point, obtained discretionary funding from their local education authority on the same basis as those studying at a university. Basically, their fees were paid and their maintenance allowance depended on their parental income. I remember going through that when I went to university in the 1980s, exactly that. I got a full grant. It was great. What was different for these students was that their local authorities varied widely in the ways in which they chose to exercise their discretion and used very different mechanisms to make decisions in this area. Matters were made very much worse over the course of the next decade as central government pressure for reductions in local authority expenditure led to fewer and fewer grants being available, with whole areas of the country in which only students from comparatively wealthy families could hope to train at the best private schools. The result was that the schools protected themselves through a variety of options. So this slightly is another story. I certainly used to get a little bit frustrated working in drama schools at hearing these tales of in the old days, everything was sort of wonderful with discretionary grants. I don't think it was ever wonderful. I think there were probably better and worse periods. This period is obviously particularly bad. But nonetheless, this is a crisis. So the drama schools at this period were really struggling. So they protected themselves through these methods. One, joining the formal HE sector, sometimes even when that meant altering training to operate within the more limited resources available outside the independent sector. So this is the beginning of the big migration towards HE. I think some people found that a perfectly comfortable accommodation, but perhaps also not. Obtaining funds from the charitable sector, commerce and industry, so that they could support students of talent themselves or provide the means for others to do so. I guess that still goes on. There are scholarships, slightly more sort of American approach to arts funding, perhaps. Increasing the number of students from overseas at full fees to make up the numbers needed for viable courses. When I started teaching in the drama school, that was in the sort of, I don't know, 2003-04, so not far from here, I remember that. I remember courses where there were sort of always a particularly large group of students from overseas. Reducing overheads and all non-essential expenditure to a minimum in order to remain in existence. This survival against all odds of an area of training of huge importance to the reputation and earning power of this country abroad was regularly brought to the attention of the government of the day. Eventually, the Arts Council of England was persuaded to use lottery funds for an interim funding scheme, IFS. This is the period of the IFS, late 90s, for dance and drama students. The scheme rules insisted that students with places at schools on the scheme were only allowed to take up their places if their local education authorities provided a minimum contribution towards fees. While this scheme undoubtedly saved the day as a temporary measure, it continued the basic inequity of a geographical lottery for students deprived of training, whatever their talents, simply because of where they happened to live. The election of a new government in May 1997, just a little bit after the article I'm about to mostly read you, swiftly led to a joint initiative between the DfEE and DCMS to agree a new system of providing grants. This was to be based clearly on talent rather than abandoned to geographical chance, and was to be set up in time to take over from the interim funding scheme, which had already announced that the autumn 1998 intake was to be the last which it would fund. And then this report, the Merchant Report, goes on to deal with the setting up of the new Dance and Drama Awards, DADAs, which still exist, actually, taking over from the interim funding scheme. Anyway, so things are sort of really tricky in the drama school in this period of the 1990s, certainly in terms of funding of students. Clive Barker's article deals with other things, but anyway, that's the context. So Clive Barker kicks off with this rather nice sort of description of history, which I think we can enjoy. He says, "In former times, training for the theatre was a pragmatic process, learned on the job. Actors have always been deeply concerned with their craft, the learning of skills, and have written often very learned treatises on the philosophy behind their work. Though acting was never easy, there was little confusion about how one became an actor. You joined a company, or you attached yourself to an experienced actor, and you learned by watching, by hands-on tuition, or from the advice Sarah Siddons gave to a young actor, always study your roles." Still, one of the best bits of advice ever given to anyone, I think. "The main preparatory work of the actor was to amass a configuration of roles learned by heart, appropriate to his or her character type and standing in the profession. A place in a provincial theatre or touring company was sought, and the roles were polished and increased. In this way, theatre flourished for many centuries without academies, although we might describe as a proto-academy the large number of theatrical families who handed on the secrets of their craft from generation to generation and jealously guarded them. Children picked up the elements of their craft by osmosis, although there were also hard training classes throughout their childhood, until acting became second nature. The strength of the families was strong and persisted, so that the Kembles, in dire financial trouble in 1829, could call upon one of their number, who at the age of 20 had never appeared on any stage, and cast her as Juliet at Covent Garden." That would have been a bloody great big theatre, by the way. "Inbred ability saved the day and launched the career of Fanny Kemble." Fanny Kemble. There's still a studio at RADA classroom called the Fanny Kemble. "Other theatrical trades were left to take care of themselves. Painters moved over to become scene painters, taking on apprentices. Managers learned their trade in business and then applied it to the theatre. This notion of learning the business is based on a very clear concept of theatre as evolving through time at a pace that each individual can recognise and assimilate. Kemble may differ from Garrick. Keane may differ from Kemble. And MacReady may differ from them all. But the choice was not between entirely different concepts of how the actor worked, but between differing styles and approaches. Charles Keane was a different actor to his father Edmund in the choices he made, but he did not invent a completely new approach to performance. By and large, we can trace a developing line through the 18th and 19th centuries right down to Irving, who refined the work of his predecessors. After this, the line becomes hazier and harder to trace. A fact illustrated by the founding of academies and by Olivier's remark that in the 20s, he and his generation had no models to follow. Though allowing Du Maurier a certain style, Olivier claimed that his generation had to invent their own models from scratch. A pragmatism, perhaps, also borne out by Noel Coward's advice to the young actor, learn your lines, don't trip over the furniture, and don't stand in front of the star. One further point needs to be made here. During the 18th and 19th centuries, strands of the theatre were kept apart. Although there were many actors who could function in dramatic theatre who could also dance, tumble and clown. The refinement and reduction of theatre style at the end of the last century left some areas of performance skills redundant and made the compartmentalising of theatre more rigid. It was considered unreasonable in the 1950s to ask an actor to sing or dance, and those who tried usually did it very badly. Interesting in terms of Clive Barker's involvement with Theatre Workshop, Joan Littlewood's Theatre Workshop. That's a pretty good it's a pretty good summary, isn't it? I think that's a nicely done trip through the period before the founding of the academies. That, of course, is at the beginning of the 20th century and a big period of European influence on people like Olivier and Gielgud and that generation of actors searching, I suppose, for acting style and also an art theatre, including the search or curiosity about ensemble, which Philippa Burt spoke about in an earlier podcast. The experimenters and the pupils. So now we're moving into the 20th century. The world changed. The theatre changed. And from the time that Stanislavski, beginning his monumental work of investigation into the actor's craft, wondered why musicians practiced every day while actors sat in cafes and gossiped, while Craig was considering a theatre which would be better off without the actors, that's Gordon Craig, Ellen Terry's son, important thinker about theatre, theatre artists have begun to devise new training programmes specific to the theoretical position or vision of theatre the masters held. The years between 1890 and 1930 were full of a rich range of experimentation, which not only questioned and often rejected what had gone before, but also tested the basic assumptions about performance and the nature of the actor's craft. Scant attention was paid to most of this work in England until the 1950s, with the exception of the work of Michel Saint-Denis through the London Theatre Studio and the Old Vic School. Probably has left out the influence of Komissar Chevsky there, Russian emigre, not a student of Stanislavski, in fact, sort of argued against Stanislavski, but certainly a peer of Stanislavski. So I think there was a little bit more than Michel Saint-Denis, but fair enough, the English weren't sort of that into those experiments. Oh, and of course, actually, Clive Barker's own Joan Littlewood was hugely influential. The people who most influenced my own generation included Craig, that's Gordon Craig, Appiah, Stanislavski, Meyerhold, Vakhtangov, Reinhard, Piscator, I think that's how you pronounce it, Brecht, and their pupils Barrault, Saint-Denis, Villars, Strettler, and for me, Joan Littlewood. Oh, there we go. It has been their teaching and practice which formed the basis of many of our ideas about theatre, many of our ideas about theatre and about our own pedagogy. Probably should add Jacques Copeau and Suzanne Bing to that list, I would think, especially given that Clive Barker was, his main book was called Theatre Games. I'm not sure where Clive Barker got his work from, maybe more from the Joan Littlewood tradition. Clive Barker continues. In the 1950s, it was still relatively easy to comprehend such a range of approaches to theatre training. During that and the next decade, the texts of Stanislavski, Artaud, Brecht and Laban became available and began to penetrate the teaching of the established drama schools. While the opening of the drama department in Bristol University in 1947 added a new pathway into the theatre, going beyond the narrow concerns of the acting school. But this was also the age of the autodidact. We studied the masters, absorbed their ideas, and constructed our own programmes. When more texts became available and new ideas emerged from Gutowski, Barber, Brooke, and others, we were well placed to understand their work and to fit it into our pattern of theatre. Encore, the little magazine of the late 50s and early 60s, deserves a lot of credit for both promoting new ideas and for providing a forum for debate. Encore's a brilliant magazine. There is a book called The Encore Reader, I think, which you can buy Encore magazine from sort of little specialist shops, but it's often quite expensive. Beautiful little magazine. But The Encore Reader, you can pick up on Amazon for a few quid. It sort of highlights from The Encore magazine. Back to the article. But the pace continued to accelerate, and those who had learned from those who had learned now faced challenges to create their own concepts of theatre pedagogy. The world was getting smaller, and we Europeans also became aware of the scale of experimentation in the United States. Then, both Europe and America discovered, or rediscovered, the rest of the world and the richness of other theatres, and we began to absorb these influences into our work. The extension of university drama departments encouraged, even demanded, the existence of all-round academics able to teach across different areas of the syllabus and, coincidentally, able to make connections between the different areas of theatre study. We may have thought we had hard lives, that we had to struggle for what we achieved in the post-war world, but in fact, we were lucky. We were the privileged generations, enjoying such opportunities to know where we stood on the world map. Young people entering the theatre today are faced with a bewildering profusion of possible choices. They stand, seemingly, at the place where entrances to many labyrinths meet. Which path to follow towards fame, fortune, or artistic maturity and satisfaction is practically impossible to decide. Interesting. So, mid-1990s, the NCDT drama school accreditation is really up and running, is totally switched on. So this is a period of a codification of distinction between acting schools and university drama departments. That distinction is very clear. And the top tier drama schools, I understand that's a problematic concept, but let's say the CDS schools, the schools with accredited courses, are a very clear bunch. So in a way, it's interesting that he still talks about the entrances to many labyrinths. That would be, I think, more true today than ever. Not necessarily a bad thing. Anyway, he goes on. A confusion of choices. There are several factors which contributed to creating this confusion of choice. I feel like we're moving into the centre of his argument, so a confusion of choice. The teacher-to-pupil chain had begun to produce a range of methodologies within the same area of theatre pedagogy, the movement work of Laban being a significant example of this. The appetite and impetus of the autodidact began to produce teachers who combined aspects of the work of a number of masters, creating a new methodology in practice. Experts appeared who developed methods for training actors which concentrated on specific aspects of theatrical skills much more precisely than Meyerhold, Coppeau, and others ever could. Such specialisation often being achieved at the expense of a total integrative view of the theatre. Some techniques derive from the theatre and are applicable to theatre training, if you possess the contextual knowledge to make the links. One can become a Feldenkrais teacher or an Alexander teacher without any connection or reference to theatre whatsoever. One can even become an expert in eurythmics without ever having heard of the theatrical work of Appiah and Jacques Delcroze. There's also the importation into Western theatre training of Tai Chi, Shiatsu, Yoga, Aikido, and other physical training disciplines. And then there are the forms of drama therapy, relaxation, radiance technique, bioart, games theory, contact improvisation, theatre anthropology. The list goes on. Never has there been so much inquiry, investigation, formulation and theorising about theatre art. Each of these areas is producing its own literature, together with a literature providing commentary, interpretation and methodologies extending the range of existing materials. At the start of the 60s, there were very few prescriptive manuals. It may not have been easy working your way through Laban's Mastery of Movement for the Stage, but at least you knew what philosophy and range of ideas you were dealing with. Aside from Stanislavski, Laban, Viola Spulin, and some voice manuals, there were few others to come to terms with, or turn to, for guidance. That's true, you know. I well remember going to Books Upstairs in Dublin, or being in London and going to, I don't know, Foyles, or where would you go? Bookshops. French's, Samuel French's bookshop, and looking at the sort of skills, well, the National Theatre bookshop, a short shelf with a few books that you saw over and over again. That's true. And now it's vast, and obviously getting vaster even in the 1990s. Then short pieces began to pour out the Tulane Drama Review, giving briefer insights into other methods. And now the range of available books is enormous. Well, if it's enormous in the 1990s, you should try now, Clive. The current Gazelle Book Services catalogue thus contains 25 books on teaching acting, and I have heard of none of them. One of them, called Mega Approaches, costs £26.50. Should I buy it or not? What are Mega Approaches? Should I tell my students, you should try Mega Approaches? A few years ago, I set about bringing that section of my library up to date, which netted for me at great expense several very important books and a lot that weren't. Gone are the happy days of lavish library funding when you could try them out in the library first. When I wrote Theatre Games, it was in an attempt to set down a possible theoretical and scientific explanation of what was then a largely pragmatic use of games and improvisation in theatre training. Keith Johnson and Albert Hunt made their own important contributions to this search for some stability in the hit-and-miss area of actor training. The shelves now are loaded with theoretical works, practical manuals, different approaches to an almost infinite range of aspects of theatre training. Some are works of great insight and brilliant innovation. Some are untutored junk. All are expensive. How to separate the grain from the chaff? Heaven help the would-be autodidact in the theatre world of today. Someone clearly has to make the choice for you, and the last 40 years have seen a proliferation of institutional and other means of training which do just this. All you have to do is guess which door to go through. But this is far from easy, and it's clear that many people make their choice in pure ignorance and trust to luck. Something I've often thought about, without ever really getting anywhere with the thought, is how curious it is that the drama schools, the ones that I know, are quite different in the way they train and quite different in the personalities of the school. That often lies somewhere in the faculty, I think, and that lies somewhere in the history. And I'm not sure that drama students ever really choose where to go to drama school. There was a period when I taught at both Lambda and RADA, and I quite often thought that a student I had at RADA would have been better off at Lambda, and a student I had at Lambda would have been better off at RADA, but they had no way of knowing that. And although, of course, you can read the prospectus and you can meet the staff and you can do the audition, you're kind of often in a situation where basically you're auditioning with a sense of where the greatest prestige is and then going to whichever school you got into. I had a student at Lambda 2 who really liked the way that East 15, for instance, did long-form improvisations through its living history and related things, and really, really wanted to go to East 15, didn't get in and got into Lambda, and is a brilliant actor, actually. So, yes, that's an interesting question from Clive Barker back in the 1990s, or observation. I don't think much has changed, really. Certainly not in terms of acting schools, maybe in terms of other things. Any incomplete listing of institutions or pathways through which training may be pursued would include the acting school or conservatoire, the university, training in a company, some form of apprenticeship, workshops, and self-direction or autodidacticism. But these choices are reduced because we cannot realistically divorce theatre training from questions of finance, whether in the area of how the institutions are financed or how the student finds the money to pay the fees. The training pathways cross. Not so very long ago, there was a clear understanding as to the structure and function of the various institutions. Drama schools trained actors for the professional theatre. The universities and former polytechnics provided an academic education in drama and theatre of a non-vocational kind. In the case of the drama school, the mark of achievement was a self-validated diploma. In the academies, the mark of achievement was the award of a degree. Already, some drama schools did include or encourage the study of world drama or other academic aspects of theatre training, while universities included and fostered the practical examination of the processes of creating theatre through classes or full production work. Certain hazy areas began to appear even as early as the 60s. The former polytechnics and colleges of higher education established heavily practical courses, supposedly justified by the assumption that they were taking less intellectually gifted students. Expected to follow the university line of using practical work to investigate how theatre was created, they began to attract people more interested in gaining experience of creating theatre and learning the skills. In any case, the concept of what theatre could and should be began to change radically through the mid to late 60s, and a less technical and less demanding concept of the actor's work followed. It should be remembered that the alternative theatre movement in Britain from 1966 to 1980 owed a great deal to the enthusiasm, energy, and ideas of the graduates of polytechnics, colleges of higher education, and colleges of art. It was a field marked by a high level of vitality and bold experimentation, and by a marked failure to sustain itself. The development of the actor-teacher from the mid-60s onwards further blurred the lines as to what form of training actors should be given when they worked in educational theatre in schools. The function of colleges of education, which should notionally have been to train teachers of drama to work in schools, began to expand to include more and more performance aspects. The best of these colleges maintained high standards of integrity, but in the weakest, it was often difficult to discern what the educational justification of the work was against a seemingly self-indulgent process of turning out inadequately and often self-deluded actors and dancers bound for the professional stage. That seems like a sort of bit personal there from Clive Barker. I wonder what experiences he'd had. Moving on. From the other side, some drama schools began to expand their activities beyond the field of training actors for the professional theatre to establish courses, ironically, in educational drama and theatre, and also in various forms of the therapeutic application of these skills. Everywhere, proliferation. Nowhere, integration. Again, that seems to be some sort of centre of thought there. Everywhere, proliferation. Nowhere, integration. I don't know exactly also what drama schools Clive Barker is talking about. I mean, I suppose Central certainly teaches the therapeutic application of those skills. Yes, maybe that's sort of Central School of Speech and Drama thing. In terms of educational drama, again, maybe Central. I mean, there are obviously Rose Bruford and the New College did that, but they sort of did that to their core. In fact, I think they started that way. Clive Barker, I think, was involved with Rose Bruford at some point. Anyway, interesting. Everywhere proliferation, nowhere integration. Among the causes of this rapid and profuse growth of institution of all kinds were powerful arguments that theatre should be placed firmly within the field of education, which served the cause of the lobby for increased subsidy for professional theatre and the lobby for the reform of education in its concern for a more interactive and creative process designed to educate through self-realisation and development rather than the direct transmission of information. To educate through self sounds a bit like some of the sort of ideas of modern pedagogy. Interesting. Secondly, the proliferation of institutions and courses was caused by more and more people wanting some form of education or training in theatre. The theatre, I love this bit, it's brilliant. The theatre in Britain somehow presents itself as an alternative way of life, separate from the pressures of the rat race and free from the interference of hierarchical structures of direction and authority. Somehow it does that. But it's still an alarming phenomenon that so many present themselves for education and training who cannot be accommodated within the limited opportunities for employment, and so are fated never to use the specific subject of their education. While it could also be questioned whether many do not get lost in the educational process, looking in the wrong places for the satisfying of inarticulate needs. It is now over 20 years, it must have been in the 70s, since I first advocated a pre-formative year for all students in drama and theatre, acting and academic, and the need is as strong as ever. Vocational or academic. Recent events, principally the effects of the economic recession, Yes, let's not forget, between the 80s and the 90s, there was quite a recession, have done nothing at all to elucidate the situation. The restriction, if not near eradication, of discretionary grants, which are all that drama school students are entitled to apply for, is driving more and more to seek the safety of mandatory finance places at universities, old and new, and colleges of higher education, to the point where these latter are now swamped by masses of students, almost all expecting a very high level of practical classes and a heavy production programme. Drama schools, alarmed by the drop in fees coming in, have tended to proliferate courses in all areas of theatre training, directing, designing and technical theatre, then in desperation seeking validation by a university in order to qualify their students for a degree, and so to access to the mandatory grant system. And the existing processes by which drama schools were controlled is breaking down. Her Majesty's Inspectorate is being disbanded. And if East 15, a non-accredited school, can receive validation from the University of East London, the accreditation process, devised and carried out by the National Council for Drama Training, largely set up to advise local authorities as to where they might reasonably give the fast-disappearing discretionary grants, has clearly become redundant. I think that would be a moot point, but interesting. The granting of degree status to drama school courses will have consequences which cannot be foreseen at this stage. For example, the fees for drama schools are much higher than those for universities or colleges, so that even the acting student in receipt of a mandatory grant is going to have to raise a considerable amount of money. One logical, if reductive way of looking at where to go might be to view the degree as the result of two widely differing equations. You pay so much, and what you get is a BA. You pay so much more, and what you get is a BA. I think we can safely say that didn't really become a problem, that I don't think... Well, firstly, of course, apart from a small number of schools, certainly the Oxford School of Drama, the fees are much higher. But as I think I said early on, most drama schools are part of the university system and it costs exactly the same amount of money to do a degree at RADA as it does to do a degree anywhere, exactly the same amount of money. I think something that people still don't understand, perhaps stemming from this time. So there's a bit of a myth that drama schools are expensive. They're in the vast majority of them are not. And I don't think the BA ever became completely meaningful. Maybe I'm wrong there, but I still think it's the fact that you went to whichever nice drama school you went to that counts, rather than the fact that you have a BA. Yeah, interesting that at this point it costs more money, because now that's what people say. They say that once it was all kind of great, and anyway. Those of us working in universities know the all too common confusion of the gaining of a degree with educational richness. The result of such thinking will send many would-be actors in search of the cheapest, most practically orientated course, usually in a college of higher education, the staff of which, already under heavy pressure to take in more and more students, will then be under no less pressure to make their courses more professionally vocational. The granting of degree status to an acting course, which includes no academic elements, raises the whole question of what a degree course is, and might make it more and more possible for universities and colleges, under pressure to raise intake numbers, to resort to structuring courses geared towards students who are seeking professional vocational training without having adequate resources to teach them. The irony is that several of us advocated the merging of university drama departments and acting schools many years ago. In the interests of training actors who were not vocationally blinkered, and drama students who could see how and where their academic studies achieved creative realization. My feeling is that we have now embarked on a rapid and comprehensive process of change where educational decisions are being taken for economic reasons. It's another fantastic quote from Clive Barker there in the mid-1990s. My feeling is that we have now embarked on a rapid and comprehensive process of change where educational decisions are being taken for economic reasons. People also, by the way, have a terrible habit of pretending that educational decisions are being made for educational reasons when they're actually being made for economic reasons. I've been around some of that. Quite a lot of that. Below the already established institutions and courses, there's a great morass. Harsh. Some of which surfaces each week in the advertisement pages of the stage. Those drama schools which have not tried or managed to gain validation from a university are in dire financial trouble. Training in theatre, particularly in the acting field, is labour-intensive and expensive. You can lecture to, say, 200 students of mathematics, but you cannot responsibly run a teaching class for actors with many over 20. The twin solutions to these problems are A. To increase the fees, which excludes the talented to privilege the wealthy, or B. To increase the number of students, which dilutes the power of the education. Neither course seems feasible when government figures give out that 75% of all drama students and 100% of all dance students failed to get discretionary grants, making increased numbers a non-option. The prospect of an acting school for the children of those above a certain income does not seem to be a serious proposition either. So the unvalidated schools are likely to find themselves in real trouble, short of students and finance, while competing in the same market with degree courses. Problems of pre-training. What is offered through the stage is a whole set of new ways of training for the profession in a variety of institutions or schools. You can train in the evening or at the weekends. You can train for a lot less than the fees demanded for established courses. Now, which of these schools is responsible and which fly-by-night is anybody's guess, since there's no register or registration, and seemingly no supervision or licence from any educational authority. I obviously cannot name names, but one attempt at some sort of survey ran across a school which did not answer any letter sent to it and for which no one answered the telephone. I wrote to two institutions advertising, asking two questions. Both courses purported to offer training which would fit the student for entry to a university or drama school. So I first asked whether the diploma awarded at the end was self-validated or whether it had the authority of some outside educational institution. My second question concerned the standing of the diploma in relation to university entrance requirements. The first institution did not answer any communication. The second rang me up almost instantaneously and promised that as one of their people was to be in my part of the world, he would bring full documentation with him. A second phone call many weeks later informed me he was on his way. Since the material never arrived, I presume he got lost somewhere in Cheshire or Stafford. BTEC courses are causing all kinds of problems. Formulated as a pre-training course to replace A-levels for those students considering university or drama school entry, their status for university entrance requirements has never been established with any consistency. There's a clear gap between what the BTEC Council put out, what the student might be led to believe, and whatever value university admissions officers place on the qualification. In these hard economic times, it's clearly seen by some students not as pre-entry training for drama school, but as an alternative to a drama school. In some advertisements, institutions seem to walk a tightrope between implying this and stating it. All this may soon be largely irrelevant, since BTEC will shortly be replaced by an entirely new and different qualification, GNVQ. Having spent 3 years getting the BTEC working effectively, staff are now becoming demoralised by the instruction to devise an entirely different format. This confused melee, another good term, is obscuring important educational questions about the function of schools and the function of universities. So again, we're getting to some good relevant stuff, although I think the whole article is brilliant. Is the training of actors, as given in acting schools, appropriate to the theatre which is likely to emerge in the future, or does it simply perpetuate the traditional style of the theatre of the past, still with us, in its desiccated state? Blimey. Sort of conversations I still have in staff rooms to this day. This is it, isn't it? The level of tuition in drama schools is, in my estimation, of a very high standard, and there's been a steady raising of levels, in spite of economic stringencies, over the last 20 years. I think that carried on. I honestly think, in general, the standard of training in drama schools and teaching in drama schools was excellent, is excellent. The range of skills taught to a high standard in a wide range of performance activities is impressive, and the actor of today is infinitely better equipped to create a theatre of dance, song, and drama than his and her predecessors. So it's not that the schools are turning out actors solely equipped to work in an outdated theatre. They're training actors for a totally different theatre whilst leaving them somehow fixated on the outdated kind. Making the conceptual leap, moving towards some kind of solution or idea. Those I've talked to recently seem never to have made the conceptual leap which many university and college students make with ease, if lacking the expertise to follow it through, that there is life outside the National Theatre and the Birmingham Rep, that the most vital and innovative areas of theatrical work are outside the established theatres. Untrained in how to create their own structures for survival while still working to their full creative capacity, they make a few small attempts at fringe productions in pubs, often in the style of cut-down versions of established companies, then disappear. New skills chasing old ends, fine talent and valuable investment in training thrown on the scrap heap. In the week in which I write this, I've sat in on an animal class in which there was fine, imaginative work performed, using animals as a basis for extended characterization. I enjoyed the work. But when and where will I see it in a theatre, except as a subdued and repressed eccentric touch in a performance in the style of polite naturalism which dominates our main stages? One aspect of a theatre which is dominated by directors has been that even when the production moves into some form of stylization, the stage is peopled by actors who seemingly carry out the director's instructions to the letter, and whose faces you cannot remember 15 minutes after the performance ends. High skill, no personality. Can universities include in their teaching any level of training and performance skills, taking into account the conditions and restrictions under which we work? Yet, given the complexity and variety of theatre forms in existence today, can we teach about areas of theatre which are advancing, or at least represent the most advanced level of the avant-garde, without recourse to practical work? If it's important, and I think it is, that we disabuse our students of the old cliché that London, New York, Paris, Berlin and Moscow are still the great centres of theatre, and that we should acquit them, no, and that we should acquaint them with the innovatory work that is being carried out cross-genre and cross-culture in small companies in often out-of-the-way places, with theatre which is trying to find new solutions to the social problems which the now discredited political theatre was meant to solve. Interesting, I wonder when political theatre was discredited. How can we make this real? If it's important that we introduce our students to the work of Garden Nietzsche, Odin Tietret, and the new experimental work of Grotowski, can we do this without acquainting them with the training and practice on which these theatres base their performance? This is still sort of the question of university drama departments, I think, or a question, is yes, how do you give people the basic level of technique? Old considerations of the interaction between scholarship and professional practice should be raised again in the context of the new forms of relationship between universities and drama schools to see if some form of melding is not possible, which goes beyond the overseeing of examination procedures. It will not be easy and it will take a long time, but it will, in the end, be to the benefit of both institutions and their students, and help to remedy the demoralisation which seems to be creeping into the practical teaching areas of university departments. Not sure what he means by that. probably the best way for anyone interested in theatre training is to join with one of those companies committed to working in a particular style, with its own clear aesthetic. In that way, a rigorous attitude to work is taught, and the actor learns directly from people who can achieve at the highest level what they teach. But the strongest of these companies were formed in the great period of experimental theatre by people who worked in the earlier experimental companies. On this basis, they have constructed their own training programmes, which have evolved over a long period by trial and error. It is not easy to join companies such as Gardnicha, Odin, or Teatro Nucleo, and whoever does still has not gone through the process of evolution. They do not possess the history. And those who train this way will find their training hard to apply. Hard to apply if they join another company or attempt to enter the established theatre. How are those who start new companies going to find the theoretical and methodological basis for their work? New kinds of participation. Leaving aside some restrictive, I thought we're sort of moving off, aren't we, in a different direction. Leaving aside some restrictive but extremely important ways, such as participation in Grotowski's work in Pontedera, what is left outside the methods I have looked at is a self-directed programme of education in theatre which takes advantage of some of the workshop opportunities given by international masters along the way. This process of networking would allow for access to training workshops at a variety of centres. More and more performers and theatre artists give on their CVs not what schools they trained in, but with whom they have participated in workshops. You're more likely to find this on the continent and other parts of the world than in Britain, but it's becoming an ever more important feature of theatre training here. The International Festival of Workshop Theatre now mounts every 2 years a festival of masterclasses open to anyone who wishes to participate. In between the festivals, the organisation holds individual events. These festivals can make masterclasses available at very low fees, but cannot yet make them free. Maybe then, it's more economic to invest what money you have in a series of workshops rather than take potluck with a school or university. I had a conversation with somebody last week about this, somebody who was saying, asking my advice about whether they should come and take a course which was going to cost them a combination of fees and moving and looking after their family. I think £50,000 was mentioned as a figure. And I said to this person about this course, this they were thinking of studying, well, yes, that would you would definitely gain hugely. But I wonder what you could learn in a different way, maybe for much less money. And that's what Clive Barker is suggesting here. Fascinating. Maybe then it's more economic to invest what money you have in a series of workshops rather than take potluck with a school or university. To do that, or make it worthwhile, the aspirant theatre artist would need to have done homework into the European theatre as well as the British to know with whom to work, and would still need a regular supply of money to acquire an introduction to the comprehensive range of skills this method would facilitate. The financial constraints serve to select. Fees would have to be made relatively high to balance the budget. To some extent, the ideal equation, which would see masters working with young actors well placed to take in the training opportunities that they have to offer, does not materialise. And once again, the master is then left working with people who can afford the fees and not those who could take most advantage of the training. How can we, A, help the aspiring theatre artist find the institution or way in which he or she would be happiest, and B, give people, in and out of the institutions, the basis on which to construct their own programme of self-development? I ask this with a disturbing feeling that, in general, people are not finding their own way to fulfilment, and that standards in performance are not as high as they should be, and I am certain, from my own association with drama schools, that there's an enormous wastage of talent, time, and money. Of course, I'm generalising. There is some excellent theatre around with very high standards, and there's clearly much more than I have not seen. But you have to look very carefully for this theatre, or to know where it is. I'm appalled by the low standards of skill and professionalism in the two national theatres and the regional reps, where the standard of work does not reflect the talent and ability I see in third-year acting students. Hear, hear. I see many groups where technique does not match intention. I see many experimental groups who appear to feel that no technique is necessary. This may be well enough if what they're constructing is a programme of political theatre where intention takes over from aesthetics, but I doubt it, for bad theatre makes bad politics. It cannot, in any case, be of any use at all in a company which has aesthetic ambitions. I have a feeling that the avant-garde is simply repeating the past, or in the words of Albert Hunt, reinventing the same mistakes. I think these are important issues which face or ought to face anyone in theatre education today. At this level, they're clearly beyond our powers to solve. We can only get to grips with them, and we must be careful not to give priority to tackling such problems at the expense of our own self-development. It will not help if we feel guilt or shame because we've had the privilege and hard work of participating. In a period of exciting developments in theatre. But neither can we sit back and pretend that we are in the right and that present developments do not concern us. Nothing is more debilitating than continually returning to the beginnings and not proceeding far along the road with new groups of students. We have a responsibility to continue our own development. It is not for us to teach. It is for us to make accessible that others may learn, and that responsibility is theirs. In this sense, pure research has a function, and we should not worry unduly about aspects of its immediate applicability. The work of the International School of Theatre Anthropology is important for those of us who participate in its programmes. For most of the time, we're expected to supply answers to questions and to be sources of specialist information, to create circumstances in which theatre can happen and learning take place. In ISTA, for a brief period, we're allowed the privilege of being a student, a non-knower, of questioning our understanding, and we enjoy the release of inquiry for its own sake. But research has in some ways to be related to the needs of the talented, eager aspirant, and the 1992 ISTA session in Brecon and Cardiff showed quite clearly that without all the contextual knowledge which we have accumulated over the years, the aspirant participant is in a poor position to understand or fully to take part in this inquiry. So moving towards the final two bits of this article. Mapping the past, planning the future. We have lived through a historical period rich in theatrical experimentation, and the prime requirement for opening up this world to others is to be able to construct for them maps of previous explorations which have created the background and patterns of today's advanced research. In this, I'm not asking for simplification, but purification. I will outline some secondary questions which might profitably provide the basis for future discussion and action. 1. So these are Clive Barker's big questions. 1. How can we best acquaint the student with the context within which to start work? It was Craig's opinion that many of the new impulses in theatre died away quickly because the people taking part did not understand the history or the context in which they were working. Italian colleagues in the Teatro e Storia group are undertaking a re-evaluation of many aspects of 20th century theatre history, and a collaboration could supplement our own re-evaluation. We, in our way, had to learn from Craig, Stanislavski, Meyerhold, Coppeau and others. How can we make this alive and useful? How can we extract the historically essential from the purely temporal features of their work, given the passage of time and the experience and knowledge we have gained? For example, if today we were to reconstruct Coppo's programme for training the theatre artist, what would we include in it and how would we go about it? And since we've grown up with many of the theatre journals that exist today, it's easy for us to forget what an important part they played in our own education. I can recall specific issues of what was then the Tulane Drama Review on naturalism, on Brecht, on Stanislavski, which were key influences in advancing my understanding of theatre. Journals now are edited and in the hands of people of the older generation, and it's easy for us in our editing, in our writing and publishing, to pursue our interests in esoteric aspects of theatre history and practice, and to forget that the early, basic stages which support this inquiry have been missed by younger colleagues. We need to look at the content of our publications, but we need also to inquire into ways in which younger generations can create their own periodicals and journals, which will not only set out essential historical material, but also face the questions of today in terms which are relevant to the people who will create the theatre of tomorrow. That was big question number one. Big question number two. Given the multiplicity of methods of training and concepts of theatre, can we work to discover a basic common core? Can we start from certain basic choices? The voice useful against the voice beautiful. Free-flow dance movement against rigid systems. The principle that action must be released before it can be controlled. Anarchy preceding order and discipline. Are there basic spatial skills? The orientation of the body in space, which must be learned regardless of what direction the actor will follow at a higher level. At the heart of such questions lie the basic skills of kinesthetic coordination, which the performer must have developed before going on to advanced work. How do we use our experience and understanding to clarify and teach these skills? Can we reduce the length of traditional training programs through a more precise focus? I love that question. Can we reduce the length of traditional training programs through a more precise focus? The answer might be no. If it's a question, the answer has to be possibly no. The answer might be yes. Final section of this paper, learning how to learn. When I see students who have left the university and become professional actors, their work seems thin compared with those actors who have gone through a good drama school training. Thin. A provocative observation. Watching actors in third theatre, experimental and independent companies, I find a similar lack of depth, not only physically and vocally, but in the connections between the various functions of the mind and body, and in their inability to break through the habitual personality structures they've built up. They're unable to transform themselves into other characters, or perform effectively other functions, such as symbolic or metaphoric actions. They have not been broken down, have not learned the systematic stripping away, which Laban considered essential, of all inauthentic action to find the core of the person from which all authentic action springs. How can we define this and communicate it? Can we take over from the acting schools the principles and practice of breaking down the personality constructs without taking over other training methods as well? Can we reach some agreement on a basic, irreducible training programme? Central to all this discussion, which establishes its primacy for us in theatre education, lies the question of how we enable students to learn how to learn. How can we put them in a position where they're able to acquire and assimilate new skills in the interest of their own self-development? We've all seen the results of poor and overambitious teaching, where students appear to acquire a vocabulary within which to describe what they are not doing. They have the right words, but their actions do not conform to what they're thinking. There are many things one can teach if the student is in a position to learn. Oh, this is brilliant stuff. Out of experience, how can we impart the philosophies of theatre we have learned? That it's a way of life, but, as Eugenio Barber has written, cannot be a substitute for life. The group which does not have a total commitment to exploring theatre will not last long. Perhaps, in our present atomised society, it's time to revive Barreau's concept of the actor-priest. How can we communicate that training is not a short period of intensive tuition, but a lifelong exercise which must be maintained as the biological processes alter balance, metabolism and rhythm? Oh, I see. I think he means he's talking about ageing, isn't he? He's saying you've got to maintain it because biological process alters balance, metabolism and rhythm. As a contribution to further concrete discussion, can I suggest, firstly, the publication of a series of carefully constructed studies of theatre experiment in the 20th century, and in the last 30 years in particular, written with a primary consideration for the theatre artist embarking on his or her career? Secondly, can there not be collaborative research to try to establish a core programme in training in practical skills which would form in itself the facility through which other skills could be learned? And I suppose all drama schools were sort of trying to do that, or think they're trying to do that. But it's a wonderful proposal, isn't it? Has it happened? Has that ever happened? Has there ever been collaborative research to try and establish a core programme in training in practical skills which would form in itself the facility through which other skills could be learned? In the messy, confused and confusing hodgepodge of manoeuvres which are now playing havoc with the established methods of training for the theatre in this country, and which are willy-nilly bringing the acting schools into the margins of the university domain, are we not in danger of losing sight of the manifold rich blessings which could come from an integration of the institutions based upon scholarship and practical expertise? Can we not try to do something to help effect this greatly desired cross-fertilisation? Phew. Well, I hope you enjoy that. I've always liked that article, and it was good to read it out loud and sort of hear it in a different way. It's mostly provocations. I think we always are. Maybe it's just the way these things are endlessly happening. But I feel that the drama school, the conservatoire, is in a similar place of crisis. I don't know where the conversations are taking place, really. I read, you know, cool stuff in the Stage. People say interesting, there were good press releases that people have got some great one-liners. I think we might need to do much more than that. And maybe we are. I don't know. Anyway, that was Clive Barker in the mid-1990s. What training for what theatre? I suppose what training for what profession might be a good question. I think some people have answers. I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you for listening. Talk to you soon. Take care. Bye.